Good evening. It is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. And tonight, we have on our line, we have John Palomo. John is a shamanic practitioner who has a lot of interesting things that we're going to discuss tonight. So welcome, John.
Well, thank you. It's delightful to be here with you and all the listeners.
Yes, it is nice. Okay. Just trying to adjust these so that the volume sounds a little bit better than it is right now. Okay. So, John, usually what happens is we typically start out each interview with a little bit about your journey and how you got to where you are. So why don't you talk a little bit about, you know, how did you get into shamanic practice? What sort of started you on your journey in this area?
Well, actually, it started quite some time ago. My background is in civil engineering, and I spent a long time in the Navy. But I met a fellow at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, and we started working with global environmental issues back in the mid-70s. And so things evolved from there. You know, some real serious study didn't start until about 1990, when I met a Native American fellow at Earth Day in Monterey, California. And we started working together, and some of the physical work involved some indigenous ceremony. So we coupled physical work building traditional structures with spiritual work, including vision quests sweat lodges and so forth. So I studied with Tom Little Bear Nason for about 9 years in increasing degrees of immersion in indigenous spiritual practice. I found it, of course, quite different than engineering, than the military, of course. And it seemed to be a door for me that had opened. And so I kept walking down hallways and looking for other doors that had opened. Specifically after 2000, Little Bear indicated that I had finished my apprenticeship, and I felt that I certainly hadn't. And he went off to do some other construction work and other business and sort of left me in charge, and I felt rather inadequate, and began to seek out other teachers, which included a Peruvian woman and an Amazonian gentleman, Ipu and Klecha. They're fairly well known in shamanic circles living back east around Washington, D.C. They came out to the West Coast and started us on a shamanic apprenticeship. And of course, they would go back to the Smithsonian and work. And so I looked for a local teacher and did find an Aztec man, and we studied together for a number of years. But I think the real wonderful door that opened was a door into shamanic studies toward becoming a shamanic practitioner, and this occurred by taking an introductory course with Michael Horner, who founded the Foundation for Shamanic Studies. He's an anthropologist who taught back east and did his dissertation among the Canibo and Jibaro people in the Amazon, and became pretty fascinated with shamanism as practiced by the remote indigenous people. And he continued his studies with the Tuvan people up in Siberia, and Aboriginal people in Australia, and so forth, and put together what he considered a course of study in core shamanism, and that is things that shamans do all around the world, no matter which continent or hemisphere they're in. The indigenous shamans do these things, and we'll be talking about several of them today, a little further on this evening. And so he brought that practice of shamanism to the Western world, eventually moving to California, just north of San Francisco, where he still teaches and shares that teaching with a growing faculty of men and women who in general are indigenous or have had extensive experience in shamanic practice on their own. And so that's sort of a short story of how where I was and where I find myself today.
Right. And was there any event that really pushed you into this area? I mean, you said that you were at...
Well, that's actually a wonderful question. I think the first event was a sweat lodge with Tom Little Bear. It was at a location in the Ventana Wilderness that I had almost gone to before. My son and I had been walking to this place in 1985, and we got up about halfway up the hill, and I said, we can't go here. So we turned around and went back. Well, lo and behold, in 1991, I walked up that same hill with Little Bear, and we had a camp and a sweat lodge there, and I knew that I was supposed to come there with him. This was still really early on in my spiritual development, so I was rather stunned by that. I knew I was home. I absolutely knew I was home, and that this is a path I should be following. And it was, you know, probably the first real door that opened onto a spiritual path for me.
And have you always lived on Shasta Mountain, or is that just...
I'm not sure if it's our distance, East Coast to West Coast, but your voice is quite weak, and I really didn't fully understand your question, Lori.
Okay. Is there... have you always lived on Shasta Mountain, or was that part of the journey that you're finding yourself on now?
Well, you know, it's pretty fascinating. That's another wonderful question. I lived in Monterey County. That was about 2 hours south of San Francisco, and it's about 7 hours south of where we live now, up near Mount Shasta. And my children lived up in Eugene, Oregon, and when I'd go up to visit them, I would always stop here and camp so I could see the mountain and bask in its wonder. And I really didn't know what it was all about. And so it just was wonderful to stop, and I kept stopping every time, going north and going south. And we came up here to explore a curriculum at an outdoor school so we could offer a rites of passage for young girls. And found this piece of land adjacent to the school, and we had no plans to move here, but we've moved here, and it's very obvious that we should be here. It's another experience of knowing that you're home, knowing that, that this is where we can really put some roots into the Earth Mother and do some good work for the neighbors and people who come to the classes and clients and so forth. So it's quite a spiritual place, Mount Shasta, that is. The little town sits at the foot of the mountain, which rises approximately 10,000 feet above the surrounding area. It's quite a beacon, and it's regarded very highly in different spiritual circles. There's two Buddhist retreats here, including an abbey, and the IM Society has a location here in a theater, and there's many disciplines of the Kabbalah and other mystic traditions, Sufism, all located around the mountain. It has a tremendous power, which speaks to the healing power, I think, of nature herself.
Mm-hmm. I've definitely heard that about Mount Shasta. So what areas do you focus on the most? What is it that you are drawn to when you think of shamanic studies?
Perhaps going back to the basic original wisdom that we entered this world with, the indigenous people practice this today, and as I say, similar practices are being taught by the Foundation for Shamanic Studies, among many other men and women who teach different approaches toward shamanic practice. to me, it's a venture into a realm which in which I don't have to worry about proving anything, in which the modus operandi is just accepting things. You know, I've walked on fire. This, you know, physically, you can't do that, but I've done it, and I've suffered no burns or anything. And it's a working in a different realm. And in that realm, just as an example, when I took a soul retrieval class with Sandra Ingerman, one of the earlier exercises was to work with a partner, and each of us would hide somewhere, and the other person would journey and ascertain where they were. She was from Maine, and I was from California at the time. And, you know, I found her on a rock in a lake, and she was on a rock in salt water, and she found me within 200 feet of where I was in the Ventana wilderness. And that's not explainable. It demonstrably showed that with the proper intent and the proper credence in this realm of non-ordinary reality, that things can happen out there. And so I began to wonder, you know, if we could do these kinds of things, how can this work to heal people, to help people? You know, we get burdened down with so many trappings of our Western society that we sometimes really forget who we are, where we came from. We don't have traditional shamans in general in the Western cultures. Yes, we do still have some traditional people within our Native American tribes and North and South and Central America and elsewhere in the world, but they're so few and far between. We have these other teachers, and we too can learn this in spite of our modern technology and the imprints of society and wanting everything now. But we can step back and get some energy from the land, get some energy from meditating and considering our ancestral lineage. We all had indigenous ancestors. Everybody did.
Sure.
It's a matter of when we broke from an indigenous culture into a slightly more modern culture and modified our patterns of behavior over time as a result of that the patterns of culture that developed. So I think in getting into a practice and actually doing some work in the classes I've taken and finding out that I helped someone was very exciting to me. Very exciting that where we could materially assist someone in dealing with issues that would relate to troubles with a loved one who died, some sort of ongoing trauma from a near-death experience, perhaps a car wreck or a near drowning, loss of a child, a breakup of a relationship or a marriage, and the shamanic practitioner works with the spiritual aspect of these traumas, allowing people to recover what they've lost in terms of power. Perhaps they've lost soul parts. And I've seen, after this work has transpired with clients, marvelous changes in people finding their own original wisdom, getting back to who they really are. And it's really exciting to work with people to help them rebuild their own foundations. And that's what I like about this. It's not like giving someone some medication and the medication does something to your body. It's enabling and inspiring people to use what they had all along. You know, I think our society is, let me use an analogy here. If we write a letter to someone and we write their name on an envelope and we can see it very clearly, Jane Doe, Main Street, hometown USA, and we put a piece of relatively clear cellophane tape over that. It obscures it slightly, and if we put another piece of tape on it, it keeps obscuring it. And if we put 10 or 12 pieces of tape over that, you begin to have trouble reading that address. And I liken that to the imprints that our Western society puts on people so that they can't really remember who they are, what they came here for. And those imprints occur from teachers or from parents, from other relatives, from the school system, educational system in general, from churches in general. It sort of makes much, much less clear who we really are and what our original wisdom really is.
Mm-hmm. So that's sort of like the soul retrieval work, as well as the, I guess, the cord cutting work that we're going to try an example of this evening. Is that correct?
Yes, we'll be trying that a little later this evening.
Mm-hmm. And that sort of relates
briefly
with...
Briefly, of soul retrieval, I've seen many instances of traumatic events wherein a soul part says, "Oh, I can see this coming, and I am not going to be here," and that soul part literally jumps out and hangs around in non-ordinary reality. And so that's a part of who someone was, and that part did not experience the traumatic event, whatever it might have been, and so it's retained a lot of its original energy and purity. And when a soul part is returned, that purity and energy and set of talents returns to the person, and it's really quite a transformational experience.
Mm-hmm. I've had an experience of what soul retrieval feels like, so I know what it can feel like when you become a little bit more whole.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a beautiful experience. You write on here, you brought me some notes.
Laura, I'm still having difficulty hearing you.
Okay. You wrote in some of the notes that you gave me about original wisdom versus original sin. Why don't you talk about that?
Well, not to point fingers at the Catholic Church, but when I was 6 or 7 years old, I was told I came here with original sin and I had to do something to get out of it. And I thought, wow, wait a minute, what did I do here? The indigenous concept is that we came here with original wisdom, as I mentioned before. And I think shamanic healing work assists a person in getting out of the self-judgment, self-blame, and back into who we really are. You know, we could talk at length about the Hawaiian shamanic concepts, which are utterly fascinating. But they suggest that we come with some sort of a blueprint that we've agreed upon in the spirit world. And when we take our first breath, we have the entry of an oversoul called the Aumakua, which brings this blueprint into our physical body. And that's how we started. And then, you know, we have these various life experiences, and they obscure the path to successfully completing the reason we were supposed to come here, and that we could call the original wisdom that we arrived with.
Hmm. Interesting. How about, so you, I assume then that you took some study with a Hawaiian shaman.
Yes, I did. I had the pleasure of working with Hank Wesselman and his wife, Jill Kuykendall, for several week-long courses. And that is, that being the kahuna shamanism, really related strongly, resonated, I should say, strongly with me, because it's sort of tied together the various aspects that I didn't understand too well in the soul retrieval class that I took with Sandra Ingerman. We can go into the Hawaiian shamanic concept if you'd like to.
Sure.
Okay. Well, the Hawaiian shamans called the kahunas, and I'll use that word, the kahunas believe that we have three souls. And incidentally, that correlates quite well with other traditions, such as the Buryat people in Siberia and some of the South America and Amazonian basin people, three soul parts, and they all have different functions. The Kahunas believe that we have a body soul, which is a ku, and a mind soul, which is a lono, and an oversoul, which is called the aumakua, and that when the egg within our mother's womb is fertilized by the sperm, we have the ku and the lono at that point from our parents. And as I said earlier, when we pop out into the light and take our first breath, the aumakua comes in, and this is an oversoul, and it's our link to the divine. Many people talk of the divine within and the divine light, which shines deep within us. I would suggest that light gets dimmed, just like a light dimmer, based on life experiences. But nevertheless, it's there, and when we can find that, and we can help others find their divinity within, we can shine more brightly and be of greater service to each other, to ourselves, of course, and to the land and nature around us. In any event, the Kahunas also believe, and I have journeyed to these places, that we have a council of elders that watches over us. They don't correct us, but they watch over us and see to it that we don't have any experiences that are not useful in terms of our growth and development. And through the life experience, the Aumakua has an ability to learn. And when it returns to the spirit world, comes a little smarter than it was when it entered into this particular earth walk. And so then speaking about, let's say, the end of life, after we take our last breath, and that Aumakua goes back to the great Aka field, the universal Aka field, where everything is and was and will be is there. It's timeless, it's dimensionless, and we have visited a whole series of places there, including a welcoming station, a repair shop, and the Akashic records, which are there, which have the records of our various journeys on our earth walks. So it's a pretty fascinating study, and Hank Wesseman studied with Hale Makua in Hawaii for many years until he was unfortunately killed in an automobile accident. I forget exactly when, 4 or 5 years ago, I would imagine.
Well, that really sounds very fascinating. And what would be the difference within the core shamanic practices? Like, I mean, if we have, I assume the elders are much like our guides or our spirit helpers, or like there's all, I guess, different lingo for the same experiences that a lot of spiritual teachings teach.
Well, a great observation, Laurie. Yes. Core shamanism captures the common things like soul retrieval, like journeying, like concepts of the upper world and the lower world and the middle world in all of these cultures. And they're all the same. And they have different words, of course, different songs, different kinds of drums, different costumes. But when someone in Africa and Namibia is doing a soul retrieval, you know what they're doing. You don't have to understand the words. And this is absolutely magnificent to be aware of. The Mayan people, we had some Mayan people staying with us, and they spoke Quiché. And we know what they were talking about, and we can't speak Quiché, Quiché at all. So there is a common thread, and that's what's so beautiful. We had a gentleman from Zimbabwe come here and visit Mandaza, and he did some exquisite healing work with friends and neighbors here. He spoke in his native language, and but we all knew what he was doing, and the people got healed.
Hmm. So it really doesn't matter from what area or from what shamanic practice you come from or from what spiritual experience and teaching you come from. We all sort of get the same experiences and the same healings and the same, because we are all one. It's not a matter of one experience being better than another. It's really how we can relate and connect, and we pick those that we connect the deepest with, obviously, and who I guess we have contracts that will help us.
Well, you're absolutely right. We are all one. We're interrelated in one way or another, interdependent. And we've forgotten a lot of that. So we try and rebuild a community to get to know really our neighbors. And there's drumming circles in densely populated urban areas, Manhattan, New York.
Mm-hmm.
There's drumming circles, every week, and people get close as they drum together and work on healing someone else, rebuilding communities, rebuilding neighborhoods is an essential element in rebuilding communities, and those communities, as they're rebuilt, sort of energetically get a lot larger, and as they touch, we have a whole region that is able to function more closely with all the little elements of people and things and nature within it, be it in a mountainous area, desert, or in the jungle, or out in the great Oceania communities among the island people.
Mm. What is sonic driving?
Well, I mentioned journeying a few times.
Okay.
Journeying is moving from ordinary reality to non-ordinary reality. Those are definitions that Michael Horner has created, and I think they make good sense to me. And it's a state that is similar to the dream time,
okay,
where everything is a very explicit and clear and lifelike. And one can journey to the upper world or lower world. I'll get into that in just a second.
Mm-hmm.
But sonic driving is something that all shamans do. I use a drum. I also use a rattle. Some people use cymbals. Some people use click sticks, two pieces of wood that are clicked together. And it's a rapid percussive sound, maybe 205 beats a minute. And it has been shown scientifically, demonstrated, that brain waves will shift from an alpha and a beta state into a theta state, which is a lower frequency of brain waves, which makes the brain more receptive to information from the other side, from non-ordinary reality. So we see Tibetan Bon shamans sometimes using brass chimes that clang together, or using a gong. The Tuvan shamans dance about wildly, as do the Inupiat and Inuit people up north in our continent here, beating different kinds of drums. And so it puts one into a state of shamanic state of consciousness, if you will, where they can travel around in non-ordinary reality to work with their spirit helpers. The upper world is generally populated by human type, angels, archangels, deceased relatives, human type forms. The lower world is generally populated by animal forms of all kinds, creepy crawlies and four-leggeds and winged ones. So one uses the sonic driving, which we'll use a little later this evening, when we do some cord cutting, to change to shift into a shamanic state of consciousness, which is, as I say, not quite like hypnosis or sleep. It's more like dream time, where you're pretty darn aware of where you are and what's going on, but the ordinary reality things are shut out.
Hmm. And so, okay, understanding a little bit about the upper world and the lower world, I'm assuming the upper world is where our spirit helpers are and our souls sort of hang out, and the lower world, is that also where, you know, some of the darker energies are and some of the lower frequencies, or is this just for animals and rocks?
Well, another wonderful question. We have never found anything except compassionate, helping spirits in the upper world and in the lower world.
Mm.
They're moral. They know the difference between right and wrong. And so, yeah, there is a connotation or an older belief that's come through the ages, I suppose, about negative things in the lower world. It's not like that. I have never found anything negative. Michael Harner has worked in this field probably for 60 years, and so have other teachers that I've studied with. We don't find anything but assisting and compassionate, helping spirits, be they a human type form or an animal type form in the upper and lower world. There is a middle world, however, and in the middle world we find helpful spirits, but we find dark spirits, shamans gone bad, if you will, sorcerers, the negative energy, which indeed can be transferred. It brings to mind voodoo in Haiti, where some dark, negative, harmful energy is collected and deliberately sent to some target person, and often causes great harm. So in the middle world, one has to be very careful about protecting oneself as a practitioner, and also be knowledgeable about which kind of helpers you get to help you out when you do some work. For example, possessions and depossession work to remove you, a person of a possession, is middle world work. And you have to be very careful in terms of being protected when you do this work, and use some special helpers who help you deal with this suffering being who is possessing a client that you may be working with. So and also in the middle world you run into spirits which are amoral. They have no clue what's right and wrong. They're just going to go do their thing. These are often called elementals. So again, you need a lot of protection when you do middle world work. But our helping spirits in the upper world and the lower world are always helpers, and they're always positive, and they're not negative, and they're always compassionate.
Hmm.
So that's pretty clear.
Mm-hmm. So the middle world, is that comparable to our world, or is that a different realm altogether?
Well, the middle world obviously has ordinary reality aspects, like sorcerers who were engaged by people who want to get even, and so forth. That's the ordinary reality aspect of the middle world, and the non-ordinary reality is just the spirit side of the middle world.
Okay. I'm not sure I'm clear yet about what the middle world is. Is that like a different dimension then from our planet, or is it still part of the third dimension, or...
If I heard the question correctly, we have, you know, ordinary and non-ordinary reality occurring in the middle world.
Okay.
And we can take, for example, a sorcerer can impart some sort of intrusion into someone physically, They can also do that spiritually. So does that respond to your question?
I think so. I'm just trying to figure out where the middle world kind of exists. Is it existing on this physical third dimensional plane, or is it also, because you're saying physical, so it can overlap into the physical world as well as the spiritual world. I'm just trying to figure, is it different dimension, or is it really part of the same realm that we're in? And I think it's kind of both from what you're saying.
Well, it certainly is both. For example, I did a soul retrieval for a person, and what I was led to was, excuse me, it was a different situation. It was a curse that had been placed on the family lineage.
Mm.
And so that's called ancestral lineage healing. And what I was led to on my journey was a time in the 1500s when an ancestor of this person was being burned at the stake for being a witch. She was being cursed as a witch. Apparently she did have some offspring, and that lineage continued and was part of this client's life today. So, you know, going back and unraveling that curse in the 1500s was obviously not in the same plane as we are in the world today, but yet, genealogically speaking, this ancestor was part of the lineage of my client.
Hmm.
So that, again, I think shows that it's in two different realms, I think you use that word.
Right. Sounds very interesting. Do you want to talk about how we get connected to cords from people, places, things?
Well, I think probably the cord that we're most familiar with is the strings of our hearts.
Mm-hmm.
Those are strummed by different people in different ways, mostly in relationships of joy and pleasure, and then something happens. Parents, children, brothers, sisters, when someone dies, you know, we're pretty tied to that person. And in some cases, it's much more powerful than others. I mean, we know that we get born and we know that we eventually die. Those are facts. But when someone actually dies, we feel attached to them in some way, and we long for them. And so this is what's called a cord. It's something that links us to that person. We perhaps have moved around a lot as children, let's say, and maybe like military families, they move generally every 2 years, but we were somewhere in the Western Virginia when our parents were stationed in that area, and we loved that place. We loved the home, we loved the woods around it, we loved the neighborhood, we loved the animals in the area, and then we moved to, let's say, the desert in Arizona, and it wasn't the same. And so we long for that place back in Western Virginia, and it works on us. It works on our heart. It works on our mind. It works on our soul, as a matter of fact. We perhaps had a 56 Thunderbird car, and someone T-boned the car and totaled it out, and we really loved that car, and we remember going to the drive-in and taking a date out and something like that, and we really remember that car very well. So these things and places and people that we are tied to by these soul strings, heart strings, mind strings, actually sap part of our energy. They take something to keep them alive. It's something like having a small flashlight left on, and it gradually drains the batteries out. These cords take some of our energy and perhaps our attention as well, and so they sort of hold us back, weigh us down a bit, otherwise drain our energy, which we could use to do other things, address different issues. And so these cords, through a shamanic practice called cord cutting, which is not unique to shamanic healers, as a practice where we journey to non-ordinary reality and invite the place or the person or the thing to approach us and be in that special place with us, and we go about cutting those cords with some instrument, and if time allows, we can do a journey with the listeners to do just that.
Why don't we do that now?
You'd like to go ahead and do that?
I think
now?
That'd be a great idea. How long do you think it'll take?
Probably about 10 minutes.
Okay, perfect.
So in order to drum, which I will do in the background here, and to be speaking at the same time, I need to go to a speakerphone.
Okay.
So some of the tones here may change, and I will go to that right now.
Okay.
So am I still on? Can I get up?
It's a little bit lower, but keep going.
Okay. Well, I'll try to get a little closer. So I'll be drumming in the background, and those of you who are listening who would like to participate in this practice, if you'd find a comfortable place, you can lie on the floor, just sit back in a chair or crank up the recliner or whatever. Just get comfortable, and it'll be a guided journey for you, and I will be using a wonderful drum that my wife made to do some of the sonic driving that we talked about earlier. It'll be sort of in the background, and I'll go ahead and guide you through this. So what we'd like you to do here is, of course, get comfortable. And as you feel that sensation of comfort, I'd like you to envision yourself in a place in nature that you're very comfortable in. It's like home for you. It's a place where all your senses are pretty well heightened. You know the fragrances that are there. You know the texture of the landscape. And you've selected a place to recline, resting against something, sitting against something that's quite comfortable, and you can kind of wiggle into that comfortable place, listening to the sounds of what it may be there, the waves crashing, the wind through the trees, the animals. As I said, you can sense and smell the fragrances of the area that you're in, the trees, flowers, water. And you're comfortable with the landscape around you. And so this is a very special place. It's a sacred place, as a matter of fact. And you can visit this anytime for a number of reasons. But today, we're going to ask you to bring in a person that you had a relationship with, or some place that you have a tie to, or an object such as a charm, a piece of jewelry, a car, a favorite recipe from a grandmother that you lost, and you concern yourself with this relationship or this thing or this place, and you want to lessen the impact of that tie, that cord that ties you to this person, place, or thing. So we'd like you to invite that person or object or location to enter into this sacred space, enter in this comfortable, safe sanctuary, if you will, and approach you, you know, without any concern. You'll ask them or it to get comfortable and wiggle down just as you have, to be relaxed and receptive to the energies, the beautiful, receptive energies of this place. So as you scan this person or this object, I'd like you to start at the crown chakra, the top of the head, and see if there's any ties there. Are there any cords that emanate from that area? Are there any cords that emanate from the place of the third eye, right between over the top of your nose, the bridge of your nose between your eyes? Is there a cord there, a cord of any kind? And how about the area of the throat? And if you're working with a vehicle, let's say, or a house or a piece of land, you can similarly look for cords at different points on this object or this place. And I'll just use the human form as an example, a structure, a skeleton that we can hang our process on. So when we left off, we're at the throat chakra. Are there ties and cords that come from this area? And how about the middle of the chest and the area of the heart? Any ties, cords that exist there? Moving down to this area of the solar plexus, just below the rib cage. There's often cords and ties there, and we envision them, and as we envision them, we might see if they're diaphanous like a spider web, or big like a mooring line for a big motion liner. Sometimes the cords are made of light, sometimes they're just particles of energy, sometimes they're strong like steel. And moving down further, next chakra, around the belly button, we find any cords or ties there. And lastly, we, on the front of the body, in any event, we look at the root chakra in the area of our genitals, what cords or ties may exist there. And sometimes there's sneaky places where these cords or ties are connected, such as at the base of the skull and the top of the spine, an entry portal there. So let's look and see what kinds of cords, if any, we find there. And then down between our shoulder blades on our back, are there any cords there? Some will have different colors, as we've talked about. Some are of different materials. Sometimes they're just pure light. And lastly, at the base of the spine, above your hips, are there any cords or ties there? You'll be able to see them and notice their texture, color. Now, after you've gone and identified these places where the cords may exist, we'd like you to look to your side, left or right, doesn't matter. You'll see an array of implements there. Could be a butcher's knife, could be a scissor, could be a hatchet, could be a laser gun, a wand from Star Wars. You'll find something in that assortment of objects which you can use to cut these cords. The one you select will be all powerful. It can cut through stone, it can cut through steel, it can cut through light and extinguish light. It's going to be very capable to cut these cords. We'd like you now to pick up that object and that implement in your strong hand, the one you prefer. And we'll start again to course through those points, again on the human form, but if you've picked some other object or some location, and you've identified points on those objects that you relate to so strongly and you're tied to with these cords, we'll just use the human form as a basic structure again and cut through those places. So we'll begin the top of the head at the crown chakra. If any cord is there, you may sever it quickly. Sometimes chop at it, sometimes you saw through it. Sometimes you pass your wand through it effortlessly. And it's gone and it's cut. And as you cut these cords, you'll see them curl up and they'll go back to from whence they came. And those cuts are permanent. They won't spring back. They can't unroll and come back to you again. You've cut those cords. And let's examine now your cords, if any, at the second point, the third eye, the bridge of your nose, right above your eyes. If there's a cord there, you may cut it effortlessly and watch it disappear. In your throat area, a cord that may represent some words that came from you or toward you, those can be cut similarly with the apparatus that you've picked up. The device will cut the cord and you can see it again roll up and away from you, working down to your heart chakra, that area in the middle of your chest. If there's any cord there, cut it. In the area of your solar plexus, if there's a cord there, sever it. Cut it with the scissors. Pass through it with your wand. Chop at it. Some of these cords are thicker than others because the ties are stronger. They consume more of your energy. You may have to take a couple of swipes or a couple of saws with your saw or bread knife. But you can get through every one of these cords that tie you to something that you don't need to be tied to anymore. Moving down to the area around your belly button. If there's any cord there, sever it, cut it, and watch it disappear. Disappear from your sight. And at your root chakra, any cords there, cords can be cut without any harm. That energy will flow back to the place it belongs. That drain on you will cease to exist because it's connected by that cord. Once you sever it, it cannot bother you any longer. Let's go to the rear of your body, or the other place in that object or landscape. See if there's a cord, the base of the skull and top of the spine, and if there is, cut that cord with your implement. And similarly, move down between your shoulder blades, cut that cord, watch it disappear. And at the base of your spine, just above your pelvis, there's a cord there. Go ahead and cut that one as well. As you watch these recede out of your vision, they have returned to that place, to that object, or to that person from which they came. relationship that was connected by that cord. You know, in an analogy, it's like unplugging that radio, that recording, because the connection is severed and there is no power to it anymore, and it speaks not to you. So as you've completed this exercise in cord cutting, you will be needing to return from this state of consciousness you were in into back into ordinary reality, thanking the implement you used to cut these cords, getting the sense of the place where you were sort of snuggled, wiggled into in comfort and relaxation. Remembering that place because it's a place you can visit again for other purposes. So these are powerful experiences. And it's often suggested that we sort of do a cauterization of the spots where these cords were. That's rather difficult to do here telephonically over many miles. But it's always good to take a shower or a bath, especially an Epsom salts bath. That will serve to heal quite rapidly the places where these cords were attached. So if you have the opportunity to do that, that would be a good idea. Sometimes if you don't have a bathtub, you can do this in the shower and use a shower brush or a face cloth and vigorously rub over these places where those cords were attached. That sort of heals up those places where they had been and no longer are. So I've ceased the drumming now, as you may have be able to hear, and we'll all try to get back to ordinary reality and continue with the remainder of our program this evening. So, Laurie, do you have any questions at this point?
No, I think that was quite wonderful, though. I think a lot of people will benefit. Hello? Yeah, I think that was quite wonderful, and I think a lot of people will benefit. You want to?
Just a moment, please.
Yeah, go back to your other phone.
Okay.
Go ahead. I said I think it will be quite beneficial to a lot of other people, which I think it was quite wonderful. Thank you. Do you want to talk a little bit about, I liked what you were talking about with other practices, the nature spirits where our feet are in Mother Earth and the trees, and just it's a lovely visualization of how we connect with nature.
Well, nature has spirits, and they are incredibly healing, I have personally found. You mentioned the trees, Laurie, and you know, trees are sometimes regarded by native people, indigenous people in general, as the elders of the elders because they've been around so long. And they do have spirits. They have seen a lot. They have heard a lot. And having an opportunity to sit in meditation beneath a tree is a very powerful experience. For any purpose that one might have, for regeneration, to sort of jump out of the chatter that our minds get into, to regain calm after hearing some disturbing story, perhaps on the radio or television, or reading something in the newspaper, sitting by a stream, and it doesn't have to be this mighty river, it can be a rivulet, the water coming from winter snows melting and going down in rivulets toward the creeks and the streams and eventually rivers, watching that flow. So I found nature to be really quite healing. Sitting in the snow, for example, certain sensations to people. There was a wonderful exercise I had the pleasure of doing once with Sandra Harner, Michael's wife, and it was going out to the land and getting a song from the land. In fact, she said, get six songs. Go to six different places and get songs from the land. This was early on in my studies, and I'm still, saying, she's got to be kidding. I can't even sing, and this is, full of hot air. Anyway, I said, I'm going to go out and try anyway. And the first two were sort of hard, and I kept having these concerns about my making up the song for, I guess the first one was a little pond with some cattails, and the second one was only slightly easier. But then as I got to the third and the remainder of these things, I was able to get songs from the land. And this was on the north pier of the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. And I had no doubt that if I sang those songs to someone, they would go to the right spots on that land. And this is a tradition used by the Aboriginal people in Australia who navigate using songs. And so the songs are shared among the people in the community, and they are used as waypoints. You know, we have our GPS systems, and we have waypoints on the GPS so we can get to the airport. Well, the songs are the waypoints for the Aboriginal people in Australia, and I'm sure they still use them. And the songs come from the land, based on what's there and the movement and so forth. So that was an absolutely fascinating experience for me, and I would suggest that you try. We've taught a few classes like that here in Mount Shasta, actually on the slopes of the mountain, and persons have, the various participants have found that they indeed can find songs from many different places on the land that they're on during that course of study.
Well, it seems that we're almost out of time, and we probably really are out of time, but is there anything else that you'd like to talk to us about, other practices, anything that we didn't touch on that, is really dear to your heart?
Well, in my studies, I've found that if you wish to really engage in shamanic healing and working with your helping spirits, you need to have a complete trust in the process, and you need to have a clear focus or an intention, such as you don't want to ask the compassionate helping spirits, where can I get some water, because they don't know if it's tea or coffee or a drinking fountain or Coca-Cola or the sewage treatment plant. So you have to be very focused in your intention, such as I want healing for my left or knee or for my cousin's left knee, which was injured in a skiing accident. And you have to have a purity of intent. If you want to use this, you can't go into it egotistically. You have to do it from the heart. And you have to call in your compassionate helping spirits. They are the ones who do the healing. The shamanic practitioner or the shaman is not doing anything except communicating with the compassionate helping spirits. That's what they're doing. And so you have to call in all this help from the outside. So trust in the process, a clear intention, no ego, doing it for a purity of intent, and then calling in help are the four elements, I think, that are absolutely crucial to being successful as a shamanic practitioner.
And how can people get a hold of you?
Well, I do have a website. It's www.shastashaman.com, and there's an email address and a phone number and a post office address on that website.
Perfect. Well, John, it's been a great pleasure. I hope you enjoyed the show. I think it was very informative and very interesting.
I'm honored and greatly overjoyed to be able to be part of your broadcast today and to share what I've learned with your many listeners across our great land.
Well, it was a great pleasure, and look forward to connecting with you again.
I do as well. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.